Et Naim, Nikki Yasam Hilo, Nikki Machuptamaidu. Hello, everyone. My name is Hilo, and I'm Machuptamaidu. We acknowledge and are mindful that Chico State stands on lands that were originally occupied by the first people of this area, the Machupta, and we recognize their distinctive spiritual relationship with this land and the waters that run through campus. We are humbled that our campus resides upon sacred lands that have sustained the Machupta people for centuries and continue to do so today.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of our podcast, First Gen, One of Many. Our mission is to create an archive of discussions with and about first-generation student experiences in and out of the classroom. We hope to continue raising awareness and understanding, provide voice for students and alum, as well as present resources for faculty, staff, and students working for and collaborating with first-generation students. Excited to be here with everybody again, and I'm going to be introducing my amazing co-host, Joshua Whittinghill. Hey, Josh, how are you?
Oh, great today. Oh, thank you for that. Welcome again. And it is wonderful to be recording once again. Mm-hmm. It's also a little surreal in a sense for me. This is an episode we've talked about and wanted to do for a long time. And then circumstances and situations around the country escalated that made our discussion even more pertinent, even though we had this scheduled long before COVID. It just happened to be that we had to postpone. And so now we'll have some good discussions today. Our topic for today, we always kind of like tease it and then get to it. But today we are going to be talking with a wonderful panel of four Hmong women. And our discussion today will be some of the wonderful parts of being a Hmong woman and some of the challenges of being a Hmong woman and other circumstances impacting the Hmong community, specifically in the North State. But yeah, and it's also surreal. This is my first episode recording not working for EOP after 20 years. I have moved over to a new job as a information technology consultant or an instructional designer and working in the technology and learning program at Chico State now. So
yeah, so a huge round of applause for Josh for that one. I gave him special permission to remain on this podcast even after leaving EOP. So you're welcome. I'm just kidding.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. I know it was a close call. It was a 51-49 vote in your head, and so I won by 2%.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. So we're going to start out. We have a quote as normal, but today we have a very special quote because one of our guests is going to share the quote and then explain it to us and the importance it is means to her and to many people in the Hmong community. It's the quote that many people are familiar with growing up Hmong. So Yur Tao, can you take us away with the quote today, please?
Yes, thank you so much, Josh and Teresa, for having me be a part of this conversation. So the quote that I will be saying today is definitely a quote that I think many of us who grow up in very traditional Hmong households have heard either from parents or just overheard relatives saying it sometime throughout, you know, parties, et cetera, or heard it in some type of Hmong movie. But this is definitely a quote that really encompasses our community, cultures, and value. And so I will first say it in Hmong, and then I'll roughly translate it into English. But this is the quote. Tu kaimbo lomba ke chai tu tuki lomba ke lao. And basically what that means is the whole reason why we raise pigs and chickens is to prepare for hunger. And so with that, we also must raise children to prepare for old age, because there is no such thing as retirement homes in the traditional Hmong community. And so sons and children, daughters, are daughter-in-laws that are actually, are expected to raise their and care for their elders in old age. So with that, we are definitely a community that puts a lot of pressure in our members to follow the traditional path, and especially women as well, of getting married and then having lots and lots of children, because you must prepare these children to help take care of you in your old age.
Thank you. I've always been interested and love hearing Hmong and trying to learn to speak Hmong and practice when I can. Thank you again for sharing that. All right. And before we jump in and introduce our panel for the day, we wanted to kind of share some basic foundational information, just some information about the Hmong community. Traditionally, the Hmong people have lived and still continue to live in mountain villages in southern China and parts of Vietnam, Laos, and Thailand. And in the Hmong community, people are identified by being in a clan, and there are 18 clans, and that is represented by a person's last name. You can see which clan they are part of. And then after being tortured and oppressed by the communist regime of China, many Hmong joined U.S. forces to fight in what is the Secret War, which began in 1961 and lasted until about 1975, with the latter years of that war being known as the Vietnam War. And since 1975, an estimated 250,000 to 275,000 Hmong have sought safety by immigrating to the United States. In 2019, the Pew Research Center estimated the Hmong community in the United States to be about 325,000. And the majority of the Hmong communities in the United States are in California, Minnesota, and Wisconsin. In the 2010 census, 91,000 reported to be living in California, 66,000 in Minnesota, and 49,000 in Wisconsin. We know those numbers have increased because according to a poll in 2018 in the Minneapolis, St. Paul area, there was about 80,000 Hmong alone. So it's interesting that outside of California, the Hmong communities are very isolated to very specific areas. California, however, has the most, but it also spans almost the entire state with significant communities all the way up to Chico is kind of maybe the northernmost community of Hmong families living, and then all the way down past Fresno into the Central Valley. So it's a big wide expanse of that. And a lot of it has to do with agriculture, right? The Hmong community coming from Laos and Thailand was really based on burn agriculture, right? And so they would grow all the crops and then burn the fields to rejuvenate the soils. And then also from some stories I've heard, and if you want to correct me, please do on the panel, but also some spirituality built into the process of the agriculture as well. And not just to replenish the soils, but also to be having a spiritual side to it. So correct me on that if I'm way off base, but that's what I've heard from some students over the years, what they learned from their families about the burn and slash agriculture practices among people. So that gives you kind of a very, very brief 3 or 4 minute intro to that. So hopefully the rest of the episode, you will learn much more about the Hmong communities and also about being a Hmong woman. So as we jump in, our first guest is Elizabeth Lowe. Elizabeth is 20 years old and currently in her fourth year at CSU Chico. She is majoring in art studio with a focus on digital illustration. She hopes to use her art as a voice to tell stories of her heritage and culture, as well as the adversity she faces being a Hmong American woman. Hi, Elizabeth. Welcome.
Hi, I'm so thankful to be on here. This is my first podcast. A little bit nervous, but excited to see what today's going to be about.
Oh, it's great to have you. And don't be nervous. I didn't share this in our planning for this, but if someone usually messes up and we have to stop and re-record stuff, it's usually me. So you're going to be fantastic. Don't you worry at all. All right. Our next guest, Teresa.
Awesome. Yeah. So next on our panel, we have our next guest who I'm super excited to introduce. We have Andrea Ta. Andrea Ta is going into her fifth year here at Chico State, and she is currently majoring in public health with a minor in health and wellness. And three of her favorite things to do are to go to the beach, hike, and she also loves things that are any related to food. Hey, Andrea, welcome.
Hello. Thank you all for inviting me. Yeah.
Awesome. Thanks for being here. Mm-hmm. Andrea, I remember meeting Andrea at Summer Bridge, and then she was in a multicultural gender studies course I taught her first year. So it's great to have you here, to see you after your years of growth and what you've learned and the things you are doing now. It's awesome to have you here.
Thank you, Josh.
Next up is Alvina Vu. Alvina is an academic advisor and admissions specialist who works closely with EOP transfer students, and she's been at Chico State a little more than a year and a half now. She was born and raised in Sacramento. She earned her bachelor's degree in sociology from UC Berkeley and her master's in counseling, specializing in career counseling, from Sacramento State. She is deeply passionate about working with first-generation students and loves helping students achieve their goals. Hi, Alvina.
Hi, thank you for having me today, and I'm really excited to be here.
And if that sounded familiar to anyone who listened to previous episodes, Alvina, of course, was also introduced and a key part of our educational opportunity program, Book in Common discussion on sort of analyzing and looking at anti-racist practices on campus. Excellent. Thanks, Alvina. It's great to see you again.
Glad to be here.
Perfect. So our next guest is Yer Tao. So Yer Tao is a supplemental instruction coordinator in the Student Learning Center. She calls herself a hardcore wildcat because she earned both her BA in liberal studies and her master's in public administration from Chico State. Born in Laos and raised in Butte County area, Yer is proud of her Hmong American, bilingual, low income and first generation background. Yer's personal background and experience ignites her passion for student advocacy, student support, and student success. Thank you so much for joining us, Yer.
Thank you, Teresa. Thank you for having me here today. It's definitely an honor to be on this panel.
Yes, we're super excited to have you and the rest of our guests, and we're even more excited to get started and learn a little bit more about you on your background and experiences.
So, whoever wants to start off, go ahead on this one, but let's just hear, right, what is something wonderful about being a Hmong woman? Whoever would like to chime in first?
I could go. So I think for me, one of the things I love the most about being a Hmong woman is the sisterhood. And so I think what's so unique about it, and I'm sure this happens in the old villages too, because I'll watch, videos of my dad when my mom traveling to Laos, and you'll see girls just holding hands, like little girls, like teenage girls, and they'll be giggling and like talking together, going places together. So the sisterhood existed back in our old country, and it still exists now. So I'm in part of some Hmong women today groups on social media, et cetera, where we do retreats together to empower one another, to support one another, and to just be there for one another. So I definitely think one of the most beautiful thing about being a Hmong woman is the sisterhood that exists in our community.
You know, I think I would say the same thing as your, I think that my favorite thing about being a Hmong woman is this like unspoken sense of like community and camaraderie that we have with one another. And I think about like the ways that we greet each other for the first time, right? We call each other sister in Hmong. And so we would say like Nhe Lao or Nhe Hloa, or we'll say like sister, right? And I think it's really beautiful because it speaks to the fact that you can meet someone for the first time and you claim them as family, and there's this sense of trust that comes with it. And my favorite type of Hmong people are the ones who go out of their way to be associated with the other Hmong people in the room. And so I just think it's really beautiful that we greet each other by calling each other sister.
Yeah, I think kind of tying along with that, I think for me, one of the most wonderful things was especially hearing stories from my mother, about her bandao, her story cloth stories, and kind of like her stories as a woman kind of has inspired my wonderful things for being a Hmong woman, as well as like the sisterhood. Like my mom would tell me that like her sisters like took care of her and she like always had fun with them. So that's like one of the wonderful things that I can think of.
I feel like for me, it's very like
I know it's so simple, but just being a woman, actually, yeah, is something I found wonderful. I know it's very simple, but just to add more context, I remember when I was younger, like, I was having challenges, like, finding my identity and connecting with my roots, and there was a point where I didn't really care much for it. Like, I didn't really care much about our language or our food or our culture and things like that until I remember it was actually my sister Jua. She told me about this one program, or it's like a conference that colleges host, and Alvina was a part of it. It's known as the Pursuit of Higher Education from UC Berkeley. And I remember Alvina was a mentor. But yeah, that program was like a bridge to, like, for me, like, connecting with my identity and, you know, it's just exploring my roots and things like that. And so, and eventually that led to, like, it sparked like an interest of, like, learning more about our culture and our history and things like that. Throughout, like, the organizations I joined in Chico State, I was a part of Leaders for Life and Hmong Student Association, and also I went to Hmong class too, and I learned a lot. So simply, it was something I just found very wonderful. It's just reclaiming my identity, like, you know, just being a Hmong woman, and also the food, of course, and our bandao, and, you know, just our history and things like that, or is something that really holds dearly to me. So yeah.
Amazing. Thank you all for sharing. It sounds like you can tell the strength and the commonalities from the experiences that you all shared. So that's really evident and amazing to learn about. So thank you all for that. What are things that you would say you find frustrating about being a Hmong woman or identifying as Hmong woman? Let's see. We can start with Elizabeth.
Okay. I think I might be the youngest one here, right? but of course, everyone's experiences are a little bit different. But I think things I find frustrating, I guess kind of the, like, bringing up the topic of, like, patriarchy, and especially with men being the head of the household and kind of woman staying at home and doing the chores and stuff. I think I face direct, like, patriarchy, especially with, like, my mom and my dad. Like, I see a lot of times where, like, you know, like, he'll mention, like, you're supposed to be in the house, like, or doing chores and stuff. And I guess that's kind of frustrating for me, because it's hard for me to express that to my dad, that, you know, like, we're not meant to, or that I guess that women don't have to stay in the house and be, like, you know, a maid, or, like, a stay in the house. And so it's hard for him to kind of, like, I guess interpret that for, you know, me, especially with when I try to tell him that. And so I think that's kind of frustrating, because it's like I want to express it to him that times have changed, and that you know, women have changed as well, and the times have changed. So it's kind of like this battle that I'm always trying to bring up, especially if it's definitely harder to bring up, especially if you're in a community where it's, like, kind of taboo, or it's hushed away. And I think that's the part that's frustrating for me. It's that I know I have a voice, but it's not really heard, because it's kind of, like I said, hushed or pushed away. So that's, like, a super frustrating part for me.
Right. Thank you for bringing that up. And it's a super important conversation too, that I feel, you know, it's personally that my culture also struggles with. So whenever we can put two heads together and see what we can do for this conversation, it'd be amazing. Alrighty, thank you for sharing. Let's go with Alvina.
You know, I think there's been, like, an increase in the murder of Hmong women by their intimate partners. And I must say that, you know, although there are amazing individuals out there who are doing, like, great work to champion this issue and have dedicated their life to helping Hmong women get out of, like, dangerous relationships, I am like very utterly like disappointed in the Hmong community at large, who still resort to like victim blaming and who refuse to acknowledge that this is a gender-based issue. Women are usually the victims and the perpetrators are usually men, you know, and there's a reason why this issue continues to happen in our community. But I think that the sexism and the Hmong patriarchy in our community, it exasperates this issue. And I would even go so far to say that I think the sexism and the patriarchy, they enable this behavior to continue. So yeah, I think that's, it's frustrating as a Hmong woman because I feel it's hard to feel empowered and it's hard to feel heard.
Thank you for bringing that up. And that's an issue that we can definitely requires, you know, its own conversation. And I wish we had, we'll do a podcast episode just on that, but it's, that's an important thing to bring up too. And it saddens me knowing that, but it's the reality of how things are. Yer?
Yeah. For me, I think one of the things that is most frustrating is the pressure to follow our the gender norms. So as some of my Hmong sisters have already said before me, the patriarchy exists, that sexism exists, the limitation of what Hmong women can do exists. And then there's this major pressure to now find a male counterpart, get married, basically lose most of your identity, focus on being a mother, focus on being a daughter-in-law, focusing on being a wife, putting everyone else before yourself. That's what makes a good Hmong woman once she's married. And I think that sucks because I, for example, have younger cousins who are hitting their 30s and they're not married and they're women. And there's so much pressure from aunties, their moms. Like I'll be at parties. Well, I will speak out and I will be like, if you find a great candidate, like auntie or grandma, bring them over. Like, you know, it is hard to find a life partner who meets your qualification, who you can trust, who has the same values as you, who is a good person. Like, do you want these young ladies to just randomly marry a guy off the street because they should, you know, because there's this pressure to be married before you become what we call ngolo, which is old maid, right? And so I'm very outspoken. I've always been outspoken to my family and extended families, but I'm always like very cognizant using my, I would even say like privilege as a married woman who has a pretty stable marriage and all of that to advocate for my sisters who are not married and saying like, yes, I married young. I married at 19, which is a great age for a Hmong girl. I have children. And I'm educated and I have a good job. So it's now I feel like almost like my obligation to also support them by saying like, they can't speak for themselves. Almost like when you're the victim and you're trying to explain yourself and everyone just silences you. So I use my position to be, again, as almost like a joke to be like, line up the candidates, you know, should we do this like mom bachelorette style? Like aunties, what do you want to do? Because I'm pretty sure like these young women are allowed to do whatever they want. They're not married yet. They haven't found the partner yet, whether it's male or female that meets, you know, their soul connection. So they should be allowed to not have to meet that expectation. But of course, they are the elders and they are set in their ways and they will stop that conversation at that party, but two parties later, it will come back up again, you know? And so I think it's just, very, I think, sad that we are the new generation and yet we're still being pressured to follow all of these limited guidelines. Because I don't see that with a lot of my guy cousins who are, again, around the same age, do not have girlfriends, doing their own thing. And there isn't I don't hear this pressure for them to go and marry a girl. And so I think that's very frustrating for Hmong women in our community for sure.
Awesome. Thank you for that and for sharing your experience with that as well. Andrea.
Yeah, I pretty much, you all have spoken what I have thought in mind too, but to like piggyback off from all of you, I would feel like then again, saving face, like, you know, reputation, I know that matters a lot in our community. And to be honest, it can be very frustrating because I feel like it really, I don't know, it just, it may form you into the person, it forms you into a person that you're not. For example, like, you know, Hmong women, we're supposed to be obedient and submissive to men and, you know, be domesticated and things like that. And if we're like off, if that makes sense, then, you know, we get looked down on, which is something that I'm not okay with at all. And that we shouldn't be bashed upon too. And also, in terms of like reputation, things like that, just kind of like connecting it with education, I have been a little frustrated, like, you know, with education as well, because I know that, like, from our community, from what I've been observing, like, you know, you're supposed to be like a college graduate, be in a medical field, be a lawyer, and things like that. And I know that that can be an added pressure to a lot of students, which is not a very healthy mindset for their kids or things like that, because, yeah, I just think it's not healthy and it's actually very toxic, because, yeah, that's what's in my mind so far. Yeah, and also adding on with education too, like, you know, I just feel like, you know, it's not right to look down on a person, whether if they're doing, like, you know, like a communication a major, things like that. That is away from, like, you know, your lawyer, medical field, things like that. So that's a portion of what I've been frustrated in our community as well. Yeah.
Can I add another thing? I think one of the things that frustrates me the most and has frustrated me for a long time is bridenapping. And I think one of the things that I am great, polygamy and bridenapping, they go hand in hand for a lot of part, but for this particular case, I'll just talk about bridenapping just because, like, it, to me, it's such a sensitive topic. I've never, you know, like, I just feel, even to this day, there will be times where I'll be on social media and I will see a video of a young girl who is 13 walking down the street. Usually this is in the old country, just because here it's illegal and you can, you know, be arrested and it's a felony to kidnap anyone. And so it's, I think it's decreased. I cannot say that it is no longer existing in the United States. So I will start by saying that, but at least it's not being done overtly like it used to be. I remember when I was a child, it was being done very overtly. And we would go to a family where there's a girl who's been crying because she just got bridenapped, and everyone's like, welcome to, you know, let us introduce you to your new sister-in-law. And she's crying because she did not want to be there. And that was just, again, something that we kept hush hush in the Hmong community. And I'm thankful to say I don't know anyone personally right now who is being bridenapped or have seen that happening in my local community, but I still see videos of it surfacing in the old country. And you can just see the pain and the anger and frustration of the 13-year-old child who is being dragged away by a bunch of men who are now going to marry her and force her to stay with him because, as Andrea said, to save face, she cannot return because she may have gotten tainted while she was at his home. And I think it's awful. And I know it's not just a problem in the Hmong community, because I've seen documentaries of it happening in other communities as well. So I know that it's a worldwide problem, but it's just, again, a continued needed conversation about, like, how to ensure that we are treating women as an equal partner in the world and as, not as like a second class citizen in so many different communities out there in the world. So to me, bridenapping is something that will always be, again, a sensitive topic to me, just because even though it's happening to a different sister, it feels so raw and real to me as a Hmong woman. And for me to also understand, like, that could happen to my daughters if we had lived in the old country, like that, and that's just not okay. And so that's definitely, for me, a very frustrating topic in the Hmong community.
Well, yeah, thank you for sharing that. I know that's something we've talked about. And I was wondering if one of you was going to mention something along those lines when it comes to this, because you've been a guest, what, at least 5 different times in the class, in one of the classes I teach for multicultural gender studies. And that's always a topic, and students are blown away. They don't realize that that's something that's still happening in the world. And then also you also touch on in a similar way of what is sort of seems to be fading away is arranged marriages in the Hmong community as well. I know when I first started and working with first generation students and meeting Hmong students in classes I was teaching about 20 years ago, there were three arranged marriages that I learned about from the students. They shared with me like, oh yeah, we're getting married, that we've been told we were getting married for a number of years now. We're old enough and we're going to move forward with that. But that's definitely faded. It seems like, is that something also you're seeing less happening? Because quite often, even though it's an arranged marriage, it also seems to be a very patriarchal balanced, or not balanced, but patriarchal based marriage, where the male and the male's family is always the one that kind of makes the arrangements and decides on what the benefits are and what's going to happen with the dowry and all those kind of things. So that also is another way that you're talking about looking at women as this piece of property and not giving them the equal rights of being a human and making choices and those. So is that also becoming much less of an occurrence?
I definitely think so. Again, I don't personally know anyone nowadays who are currently like in a arranged marriage, but I know like the generation that's 10 years older than me. My cousins, for example, I went to a funeral a few years ago, and it was mind-blowing to, as I was going around meeting cousins from out of state, to be like, oh, we're arranged marriage. Oh, I'm an arranged marriage to my husband. And just to know the intricacy of like how interrelated we all are because of all these arranged marriages, again, between cousins, because of opposite last names. So like a mom and her brother marrying their children because of, they don't have the same last name. But even about 5 to 10 years before me, my age, that existed a lot for sure, Josh. And then nowadays, I don't think I know anyone, at least in my circle, who are a part of an arranged marriage, but I'll also see what the other three ladies have to say.
Okay, I would think you'll back off on your two. I feel like personally, I have never heard of anyone who are in an arranged marriage, nor have they been bride nap or anything like that so far. So yeah, go ahead.
I think it just, I feel like this kind of applies to like the older generation, especially with like my parents. Their age is like around like 50, like almost 60. So like I do know a few people who have been bride-napped or like arranged marriage, but I feel like nowadays, since I think the younger generations understand the process more, they try to avoid people who are related to them, or they try to avoid people who may have the same last name, but they're not related to them at all. Or they just completely avoid Hmong people because they're like, it's just really like frustrating for them to like be like, hey, you might be related to me. And then like you tell them your parents' name and they're like, oh yeah, my parents know your parents. So it's like really frustrating. So I think for younger people, it's definitely different now. So yeah.
You know, I think I do know someone who was bride-napped. She's a year older than me. But yeah, I as for like arranged marriages, I don't see that happening anymore. Thank God. I think parents are probably allowing their kids to have a little bit more autonomy. But I think something that also is similar and it probably doesn't really happen that often anymore is like when you go out with like your partner really late and you come home, sometimes the parents of the girl, they would force the boyfriend to marry her because they stayed out too late. And so they're assuming that she's tainted, quotes. And so, yeah, but I don't think that's happening a lot these days too. Yeah, that's just my perspective.
All right, I know that isn't always easy to talk about some of the frustrations, you know, that you're experiencing personally or seeing personally, especially in your community. Like you all kind of touched on, you see it and it becomes a visceral experience for you. So thank you for doing that and getting that out in part of this discussion, because we know, or at least I know, that you're already all having those discussions on your own. And this is one of the wonderful things that we wanted to do to help make some of this discussion more public so people can hear about what's happening with and for the Hmong community. So let's segue then to the time machine will go back in time and ask each of you if you can share a little bit of what your journey to higher education sort of has been. And if you want to touch on some things from elementary school, whatever it was that you kind of remember of your interest in education and what that journey has been like for you. And each of you can share for a few minutes. That would be great before we get to our recommendation section. So Andrea, if you would like to share.
Yeah, thank you, Josh. So mainly focusing on my higher education journey. So far, it has its good moments, and of course, it has its challenges, I would say. But I'm just very overall thankful to have like a huge support system that were able to get me through where I'm at right now. So I have like a year left before I graduate, and the finish line is very near, but I wouldn't get there if it wasn't for like EOP, Upper Bound, my family, friends, and just people who are there for me. So, and you know, I have been, again, I have had moments where like I want to drop out or I'm so done with this class and things like that. But yeah, perseverance goes a long way. It really does. So yeah, that has been my academic journey. And then again, hopefully post-grad, I'm thinking about continuing possibly either at a grad school or a community college up in SAC. So we'll see how that goes. But yeah, other than that, thank you, Josh.
Oh, great. Thank you for sharing. Like I mentioned a little bit earlier, it's been really wonderful to see you grow. And from your first day in the classroom, you weren't shy. You were very engaged with your education. I think that's important that people hear that. One thing that helped, I think, Andrea get through was she was always asking questions. She was willing to answer and put herself out there, even in uncomfortable situations around other classmates. And you can see a lot of growth that she gained from doing that for herself. So she was part of her own support system without even realizing it.
Thank you, Josh.
Yeah. All right, Elizabeth.
Okay, so I guess kind of starting, I guess it kind of started like in high school when, not started in high school, actually as a kid, from when I can pick up a pencil, was kind of like, kind of started, I guess, my creative and artistic route. I had always been drawing since I was a kid, and I can remember teachers remember me for drawing on my worksheets all the time and doing all of that. But I think, I've grown so much from, especially with my experiences, and especially being here now, it was definitely tough. But I think also right now, I'm currently trying to challenge the norm of not going into the medical field or being like something that my parents really want me to do, especially when I meet other Hmong people, Hmong peers, or Hmong students who are around my age. I hear like their majors, they're all biology majors, history, like something more logical. And then I'm struggling with the fact that my parents think that, you know, I'm not going to make it, you know, it's going to be tough on me. And, you know, I know that they're a little bit worried because they care, you know, of course, and they want me to be successful. But I know I will if I keep persevering and trying really hard, because I do have a support system, but it's kind of tough, you know, when you hear your parents like say that, you know, they think that you're gonna fail, or so it's a little tough for me right now. But I think at the end they'll see that I'm okay. And I think my educational journey, it's been really hard, but it's been really rewarding because I've been able to do to break the mold for other Hmong younger, not just younger Hmong women, but just Hmong younger Hmong generations in general, just to kind of set that foundation for them, because nobody really set it for me. And so I think I really want to be that inspiration for others. So I'm hoping that in the future I will be able to you know, express that for others and help them really try to get through some of the things that I've gone through and really try to help them. And, you know, like Andrea said, like the a lot of the programs like EOP and especially with, I guess, the support system, it's been really helpful, especially if at home, you know, things are not the best. But yeah, it's been a journey. So I'm really glad that, you know, I have this, you know, support system, especially here to talk about this. So, yeah.
Yeah, thank you for sharing some of that. And I know I am excited to eventually see where your artwork goes and what you accomplish with that, because I know that's one of my passions of curating art shows. And unfortunately, as we talked about prior to this show a little bit, you weren't able to get stuff into the EOP student show because everything was closed down right when that sort of time came up. But it will be fun to see what you do and how you utilize that to even inspire more. I'm sure you are already with a lot of people in your community and some of the younger students at Chico State that you're already meeting and working with as well. But I also wanted to kind of point out the message you said a little bit about parents not understanding. And I think that's an extremely important message for first generation students across the board, is that this abstract world of getting an education to then go find a career doesn't make sense because it's not something familiar for many of the parents. And so they don't see the immediate benefit or the immediate outcome, because a lot of families and parents that, you know, parents of first generation college students, they're used to seeing someone immediately going, oh, yeah, I applied for a job. I got a job. Now I'm working. And that is a lot quicker. And it happens, you know, in maybe a period of 3 or 4 days or 3 or 4 months, whatever that time may be to get hired. But that's an important message for everyone listening who's first generation student, that it takes the time, keep the perseverance going. And when you get to that point and you have a career, I know that's when I hear from many students after they've graduated and are working, all of a sudden they'll reach out and let me know, oh, my parents finally understand, because now they see that I have a job that has health benefits. I have a comfortable job. I love doing what I'm doing. And they also appreciate really the economic side. They see that the amount of money I'm getting paid is more than what some of the other generations have combined for years because of putting that time in. It just took that effort to get there. So thanks for sharing that. That's an important shared experience for sure. All right, Alvina, can we hear from you?
Yeah, I think my educational journey is similar to what you just shared, Josh, what you and Elizabeth talked about. I'm a first generation college student. My parents didn't speak English, so they could never really help me with schoolwork. But I feel very blessed that, you know, while I was like in school, like even elementary school, you know, I always had teachers who were amazing and who always saw potential in me. And I remember like in elementary school, like I was reading like a little bit like above my grade level, but I wasn't like reading like at the next grade level. And my teacher knew that when I went home, like no one was gonna read with me. And so he like kind of like set this thing up where like during reading time in class, I would like leave class to go read and get that individual attention with like a teacher's aide or something. And I think that helped me a lot. I think that helped me a lot to just enjoy reading. And I just remember like in elementary school, like I read all of the books in our class. And I, you know, my parents weren't gonna buy me books at home. And so he like, I don't know if y'all remember like the Scholastic like book thing with like the, yeah, where you like can order books. So my teacher gave it to me and he's like, hey, like, why don't you pick out a book and I'll buy it for the class so you can read it because you've read all the books in the class. And I was like, wow, like that's really nice, you know, and I chose one. He's like, oh, like choose a couple more. And I remember I chose like a bunch that I wanted to read and he bought them for the class so I could, you know, have something like new to read. And I think that really helped to like just, you know, it really helped me to enjoy reading and to enjoy writing. And I think that really like just helped like the trajectory of my life because I feel like it really helped me with vocab and being able to advocate for myself and to express myself. So, you know, I think that really helped me to do well as a high school student. you know, I worked really hard too. And then I went to a decent university, you know, but even then, I think because I went to like underserved high school, and even though I did really well in high school, I still was not prepared for the academic rigor at UC Berkeley. Yeah, I struggled a lot with the transition to like college life. And I talked to a lot of my advisors. They encouraged me to go to a lot of study skills workshop. And I did, and I eventually got it. Yeah, so I would say that I think for me, I wouldn't be where I am without the help of like just a lot of external people, teachers, advisors, counselors, who all saw potential in me.
Great, thank you. And it's always fun to learn a little bit more about you. We only got to work together in person for 3 months and then all of us on the computer. But yeah, that helps definitely shine some light and explain your zest when we talk about articles and reading of your early days of wanting to be such a reader. Because not everyone has that. No matter what their background is, they don't really like reading ever. So
yeah,
they just do it to do it. Even college graduates just sometimes read to read. But it's fun to hear that that's one of your side hobbies, I guess, that you like love to read so much. Yeah. All right. Would you like to share?
Sure. And, you know, it's really cool to just thank you, everyone, for sharing. I enjoyed learning about y'all's educational journey so much because so many parts of it resonated with my own journey. I think I'm probably the only one that was not born in the United States in this panel group, correct? Okay. So I think that's what makes I used to look back, I'm like, no, my journey wasn't very eventful. And I started really thinking back and I was like, dang, it definitely was. And so let's go way back. So I was born in Laos and I spent my early childhood in the Thailand refugee camp. And so had very little exposure to education, English, and all of that stuff. And I came to the United States when I was 4 and a half, so about 6 months before I started kindergarten, basically. So as I was just transitioning to like life in the United States of America, I was also being enrolled into kindergarten. And I remember showing up to kindergarten and just not understanding what the heck was happening. And I think one of the things to this day that I can credit for my love and passion for education and for the fact that I didn't get discouraged was, as Alvina had said, just very supportive teachers who were so kind, so understanding of the immigrant experience and the second language learner experience. I've never been shamed or ridiculed or embarrassed for not being able to understand or speak the language. And I remember being a kindergartner, and to this day, I'm just like, wow, five-year-old Yur like kicks ass, because she would literally look around and if people got up and got in line, she got up and got in line. I remember the teacher had to come and tell me, your last name is a Tao, and like physically move me to the end of the line because I didn't know how to spell my name. So I didn't know what was happening. I didn't know what getting into alphabetical order means. Like, I could not understand the most simplest instruction because I just didn't speak the language at all. And when the kids got up and got their crayons, I got up and got my crayons. And so I survived by basically looking around me and seeing what other kids were doing and following what they were doing. I think I was also very lucky though, because as that was happening at school, at home, my family has always valued education. I was very shocked when I got older and learned that not all Hmong families value education, especially education for girls. So I've met women later on who said, like, my mom and dad said, when I got home, homework is out the door. You need to cook, clean, take care of the siblings, take care of the house, because you are just being prepared to become a wife. So again, very traditional mindset. But my mom and dad had always just said, you know, honey, we do not have the money, the relationships, or the connections to pull you out of poverty. And we lived in the ghetto on welfare growing up. And so they said, if you want to get out of poverty, you're going to have to use your education and you're going to have to do well and get a good job to get a comfortable life. So I've always understood growing up that that was my key out of poverty. So I always took it very seriously. And again, first grade, still did not understand any English, but my mom and dad worked on alphabets with me, my letters with me. My dad would read to me almost every day. And so by second grade, I can still remember, was the first time I understood directions by myself. And after that, I just kind of like swallowed and ate up all the books I could. And very similar to Alvina, loved reading and became like the top reader in my class. And by third grade, me and along with five other third graders were going to do English with like fifth graders during the English curriculum, just because we were so advanced. And in fourth grade, I was doing it with the sixth graders. So again, so different from that five-year-old who couldn't understand what getting in line alphabetically means. And so to this day, and as I transitioned to liberal studies when I was an undergrad, I was always very cognizant that every child deserves to learn at their own pace and that they will get there. It's just they might get there slower than others, depending on where they're coming from, depending on their background, depending on their support. And so again, I navigated my high school years, graduated, came to college, knew I wanted to get a good job, but was undeclared because I did not know what was out there because my parents had no idea beyond doctor, nurse, engineer, teacher. So those are like my four options. And I was like, oh, I'm not sure if I want to do those, any of those four. So I was undeclared for 2 years and I took all my undergrad, which was the recommendations. It was just take your GEs, figure out what you like. I liked them all. So I was still, again, very confused. And then I luckily got a job as a residential advisor with the Upward Bound program the summer of my sophomore year going to junior. And I fell in love with working with low-income first generation students because I see a reflection myself in all of their faces, their confusion, their frustration, their lack of self-worth. I was like, I've been there, you got this. And I came back and I said, I want to be in education. And so my mama again just said, well, then be a teacher. So I said, sure. I got into liberal studies, was about to graduate. That was when my Upward Bound senior started graduating, coming to Chico State. And that was when MySpace was a thing. So they were like MySpace messaging me, emailing me, texting me, like, can you meet me? I need to ask a quick question about X, Y, and Z. And I would like refer them to advising, refer them to registration, depending on their question. And that was when my husband, I was married at the time, when he said, you know, you're really good at this and you do it for free. Have you considered working in higher education as an advisor? And I remember my like entire world just like shattered. I was like, wait, I have other options outside of teaching, engineering, doctorate, nurse. Like I had never even, like, as I walk in to talk to Josh and Cecilia and all of that and like loved all of them, it never occurred to me that I could do that as a career. I mean, when we talk about students who are first generation low income coming in and not knowing what they don't know, I mean, like not knowing what they do not know, like that it's to the level where I did not see myself doing anything outside of those four things because it was just never in my world to do anything outside of those four things. And so I changed my path, got my master's in public administration and never looked back and have just been super happy with my career. So that has been my educational journey. Thank you for asking.
Wow. Well, thank you for sharing. That is quite the journey. And I am thankful to have been part of it at some point, even I think being a supervisor for you when you were an intern working in EOP. But I just made me think of, I just want to be able to reach back in time and give the five-year-old, you're a big hug.
Thank you, Josh. She appreciates it.
Oh, thank you. But people around your and Alvina, Elizabeth, and Andrea would benefit now if they acted like the five-year-old you're and watch what you four do and then go do that, like just copy what you're doing. Because what I've seen from all of you is amazing work and all very compassionate and intelligent and motivated to improve on yourself each day, but also help others improving on themselves. So I'm going to keep copying you, you're.
Thank you, Josh. That's such a compliment.
Well, hey, got to speak the truth here on the podcast. So, all right. Now, as we transition again, unfortunately, time has caught up to us and is telling us that we're out of it. So we're going to go into the recommendation mode. Okay. So Elizabeth, can you go ahead and share your recommendation for the day?
Yeah, so I've shared a website card, which is basically just a website of information on anti-Asian violence resources. This website is just a really good platform to kind of see what's going on within the current trends of especially what's happening with the government and anti-Asian violence, and kind of the resources that you can reach out to, especially if you are in need of help or you want to help, especially with the Asian community. So yeah, that's my recommendation for today.
Great, thanks. And again, all of these recommendations will be in the show notes, so you'll be able to see them. All right, I know you have a couple for us today.
Yes, thanks, Josh. So my first recommendation would be to check out the Hmong author Khao Kalia Yang. She is phenomenal, and she writes so many books and poems about her and other Hmong experiences in the United States. So the book that I particularly would recommend of hers is called The Late Homecomer. It's a great book about her experience navigating the refugee experience in Thailand, and then transitioning into the United States and finally getting acclimated. And so it's such a great experience to see it from her lens, because again, it mimics and mirrors so many other Hmong experiences of transitioning to the United States. So it's a great way of getting that that view and perspective if folks are interested. Another recommendation would be a podcast by a good friend of mine. Her name is Paw Nu Vu, and her podcast is called On Becoming Educated. And this is a great podcast for anyone who is interested in learning a little bit more about the educational experiences of Hmong individuals in particular. Even though this is unique to Paw, who is a Hmong woman of first generation and low income background, so many of her stories and anecdotes are definitely relatable to a lot of individuals, including myself. She's now navigating her PhD career, and so that's what a lot of her podcast focuses around, but she also shares a lot of her journey going K through 12 as well. So it's a great podcast.
Excellent, thanks. And if the name Paw Nu Vu sounds familiar, she was a guest back on episode 6 when we did an episode on music and language. And she was so gracious enough to join us during her first week after she moved to the San Francisco area, and she was navigating just a new living space, but also starting her classes also. But yeah, so Paw Nu Vu's website is wonderful, and her podcast and blog and vlog and all the stuff she has out there is great. All right, so Alvina, what do you have for us today?
Yeah, so my recommendation is the HmongStudiesJournal.org. And the Hmong Studies Journal, it's a peer-reviewed, internet-based academic publication devoted to the scholarly discussion of Hmong history, Hmong culture, Hmong people, and other facets of the Hmong experience in the U.S., Asia, and around the world. So I went to a research university, and so when I got really into research and things like that, some of the upperclassmen at UC Berkeley, they shared this with me, and it just like changed my life, right? Like you're reading so much studies about Hmong folks, and they're like new studies, right? Because like, and people were studying questions that I always like was wondering, and questions that I had. Yeah, and so anybody who's interested and you're trying to learn more about Hmong people or learn about yourself, I think it's a great resource.
All right, yeah, thank you very much. And so if you haven't noticed, Teresa did leave. She was voted off of the podcast. So no, she had to go for another appointment. But yeah, so thank you, Teresa, again for hosting with me. And thank you all for being here. It's been another wonderful episode. I'm glad we finally got to do the episode, and look forward to all our future possible endeavors together as I see you around campus and town and learn more about what you're doing in the world. So thank you, listeners. Xin Jin Dua.
Xin Jin Dua.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks, Josh.